Thank you very much, Vern. So as you can see up on the screen there, we've managed to negotiate a closed session for this final session of the day. So if there are any media present, please be aware that the views expressed by presenters are not available for publication in this session. So hopefully that will engender a lively discussion for the last session of the day. So in this final session, we'll be talking about organising the response to risk, and basically what we'll be looking at is considering the governance structures in place to support sound risk management, and in particular the interaction between the board, the senior management and the chief risk officer. So we'll start with a presentation from Nicolette Rubinstein, and then after that we'll be joined by a panel for discussions. So we have left quite a bit of time for discussion time. So just first of all to introduce Nicolette. So Nicolette is the Vice President of the Actuaries Institute, and she's also a non-executive director in the wealth management industry. She's an experienced senior executive. She's held three general manager roles at CBA Colonial First State, as well as senior positions at BT Funds Management and at Towers Perrin. She was a director of ASFA for 8 years and was the chair of its Super System Design Council. For her work in superannuation policy, she's been awarded an ASFA Distinguished Service Award and an inaugural Financial Services Council Industry Excellence Award. She's a UNSW alumni leader and is a member of Macquarie Uni's Faculty of Business and Economics Industry Advisory Board. She's also the author of a recently released book called Not Guilty, A Guide to Career Mums. And I would like to welcome Nicolette and say that I'm very much looking forward to reading her book, so that I can gain some tips and tricks as a career mum myself. So, welcome Nicolette.
Thank you, Nolene. I think I probably feel a bit more confident talking about career mums than I do about risk, actually. anyway, good afternoon, everyone. So my key proposition today is going to be that the key to organising the response to risk is open conversations. And I'm just going to start, though, by giving you a little bit more detail about my background, although that was pretty comprehensive. But I just wanted to stress that I've only really entered this non-executive director world in the last 18 months. So I did start my career as an actuary in the insurance and superannuation space, but most of my career has been in this sort of non-traditional area, a lot of strategy, product and marketing. So the reason for talking about that is that it's not been in risk. And I wanted to say at the start that I really do not consider myself a risk expert. My NED positions are all in the wealth management space, so an insurer, a superannuation fund, a startup fintech player, and a listed technology player. And I'm going to pause there and just ask the audience a few questions, actually. So first of all, how many of you attend board meetings on a regular basis? Show of hands. Okay, good proportion of the room. How many directors, are there any actual directors in the room? I heard one over there, so any other directors? One, two. how many of you have done the AICD course? Oh, fewer than I would have thought. And this is a fun one. How many of you have ever read one of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books? Are you just trying to put your hand up for every question? okay, not so many. so I would currently describe myself as a bit of a sponge. I am in the process of learning a new skill set. So away from managing, leading, controlling, organising people, and towards learning about governance, corpse law, risk, the difference between what management does, what the board does, and a very different slant on leadership. So I thought, for the purpose of this presentation, that I would share with you my observations and reflections as someone who sort of comes to this risk environment with a fresh pair of eyes. So I've called it Diary of a New Director. So how do we have these open conversations? I'm going to try and focus on the sort of softer skills and give some practical examples. I'm hoping that you will find them interesting and not stating the blindingly obvious. If we imagine our risk environment as a sort of dark room, and in this dark room there's these obstacles of all different shapes and sizes that are the risks, then the open conversations in my mind are like the flashlights that help you illuminate some of those obstacles and help us navigate them. And the flashlights also help us to work out a path if we happen to stumble on one of the obstacles by mistake. So I think that open conversations can often be difficult and awkward to have. It is easy to avoid having them and just hoping that things will work out for the best. They require a high degree of trust between the people involved. They need strong process to make sure that that flashlight is as bright as possible. And they need good strategy to make sure that you're pointing the flashlight in the right direction. Now, I can't help myself with a background in strategy. I had to have a framework for how to attack this presentation. So I've used this one, the people performance process, which some of you would have seen before. It's often used in a funds management context. So I'm going to use that to try and answer this question, how can we have more open conversations? So I'm going to start with people. So when it comes to trying to have sort of more open conversations, not surprisingly, people is where a lot of the ideas really boil down to. And the first critical component is relationships. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about my process for actually being offered and choosing board positions, because at the end of the day, it did all come down to relationships. So my UniSuper position, the chair is Chris Cuff, who I'd worked with at Colonial First State, and the CEO is actually an actuary, Kevin O'Sullivan, who I'd worked with at Towers Perrin. For One Path Insurance, Ian Lachlan is the chair, who you heard from this morning, and I knew him more by reputation in the industry. But the group executive there is Alexis George, who I had known. We'd worked together at BT. And the small fintech player was actually started by Jeremy Duffield, who was the founder of Vanguard in Australia, and I'd known for a long time through the industry. So when it came to doing sort of due diligence on some of these companies, I obviously did the usual financial checks and that sort of thing, but I actually even amazed myself at how much my selection came down to the people that were involved and the trust that I'd sort of built up as a result of those relationships over time. It is stating the obvious, but relationships are the foundation for open conversations. And having those existing relationships just means that the barriers to that communication are so much lower. So there was a couple of instances when I was approached for board positions where I'd never heard of the company or didn't know any of the people on the board or the CEO. And I found it incredibly hard to make decisions about those companies. I didn't have any conviction about whether it was the right thing to do. I kind of felt that it was a bit like wrestling with smoke. I also recall my first meeting at UniSuper and walking into a sort of long boardroom table where there was sort of 10 other directors, 10, you know, probably 10 staff members, there was internal auditors, external auditors, and, you know, that is quite overwhelming, actually. So it took me months just to learn everybody's name, let alone build relationships. And it's amazing, you know, some of the other directors sort of reached out, asked to catch up for a coffee or, you know, we had dinner together, that sort of thing. And I look back and I think when the issues do arise in a business, and they arise in every business, it's amazing how it's those people that I would, you know, look to talk to and pick up the phone to. And at the end of the day, it's that those strength of relationships that you need so that you don't have any hesitancy at picking up a phone or organising a quick chat. So that's relationships with other board members. But what about relationships with staff as well from a director's point of view? Again, using UniSuper as an example, Kevin O'Sullivan is a particularly open CEO, and he very clearly communicated to us that he was happy for us to build relationships with his staff directly. And that is actually very useful from a board member's perspective, for the CEO to give you very clear guidance on what they are or aren't comfortable with. And I recently heard of an example where the board members actually have to go through a procedure or a process if they want to speak to staff, and they're not actually allowed to even link into staff members. So that's sort of the other extreme, if you like. So my personal policy is that I make sure that the CEO knows if I'm meeting with a staff member. And I also will loop back to the CEO if there's anything that sort of relevance that comes up during that conversation. I have found it very useful when staff members try to reach out directly and ask to catch up for a coffee or something like that. I found those meetings very, very beneficial. But I'm very conscious of getting that balance right as well. You know, the purpose of those meetings is to build relationships, for me to understand the business, and, you know, to share views on things. But you've got to be very careful at not going into the, you know, interfering and managing the business sort of zone. I also think that those sort of meetings can be contextual as well. So what's right in one situation, you know, when everything's going really well, might be different when things aren't going so well and you might want to dig a bit deeper. So that's relationships. The next aspect of people is org structure. The specific question we were actually asked for this session was, do current organisational structures support sound risk management? Alternatively, how can governance structures be enhanced to assist organisations in responding to risk? So when I read that, I kind of had one of those flashbacks to one of my actuarial exams where you stare at it and you go, oh my God, I've got no idea how to answer that question. Anyway, I thought about it a bit, and my general view is that the org structures work generally quite well. So, you know, having a head of risk who reports to the CEO but also has a direct line of sight to the board, the three lines of defence, audit and risk committees that are well-skilled. So the only couple of observations that I'd make in relation to org structure are the three lines of defence seems to work quite differently in different organisations, and even within the same organisation in different divisions, it seems to operate differently. So it does seem to be very much an evolving model. And my other observation is about audit and risk committees. So having come from superannuation has combined audit and risk committees, whereas having joined a life insurance company, I then saw how it operates when you separate them out. And I have to say that I kind of saw the light when I saw how it operates with them separated. That does seem to be a better model. But generally, I would say with org structure, generally a big tick. I actually think that capability is a much bigger issue than the org structures that we have. So my observation at looking at risk professionals over the last 15 years is that it is still very much an evolving profession. There are great risk professionals and there are some average ones. And I would actually even go as far to say that the gap between the best and the worst is greater for risk professionals than almost any other profession that I've come across whilst working in financial services. So I think, again, indicating how much of an evolving area it is. I also think we're asking a lot of our risk professionals in terms of the skill set that we would like them to draw on. So you know, risk, legal, financial, understanding of operations, and now a deeper and deeper understanding of technology-related issues, and probably most importantly, interpersonal skills. So it requires a really special kind of person who can build up that those sort of business partnership relationships and that trust with their peers at the management table, whilst also having this hotline to the board where they, you know, where they can, relay, big ticket items. And I think that, requires a particular kind of personality. The final aspect I thought I'd talk about in terms of people is the role of the chair. And there is an old adage that says, get a good chair, get a good board. They ultimately drive the quality of the board members, what goes on the agenda, the relationship with the CEO, they steer the decision making, they set the tone, and most importantly, they control the behaviours. Another interesting one for me is actually the diligence of the chair. So someone who will spend time on the agendas for the meetings, meeting with staff, the CEO beforehand, and invariably reading very long board papers. So I think chairs are a very vital determinant of how open these conversations are. They are responsible for creating an environment where both the board members and the staff feel safe and feel safe to ask so-called dumb questions. And I'm reminded of an example, the Trio case study, where I understand the directors were asked to consider a deferred purchase agreement, which turned out to be with a counterparty that didn't exist. Now, it's easy with hindsight, but you look at that and you see that you need an environment where your directors are comfortable about asking what a deferred purchase agreement is, and not only asking a first time, but asking a second time if they still don't understand. So that requires a very supportive and cohesive environment. A director once told me that the best directors are the ones with low ego and high intellect, and I think there's a lot to be said for that. People with low ego, it's much more conducive to asking the good questions. Okay, so the next aspect of that I'm going to talk about is process. And there's probably two aspects of process that sort of jump to mind for me. The first is the risk reporting process, and the second is decision-making processes. So on risk reporting, I guess risk reporting is your number one way of making sure that you have open conversations, because it's really a lot easier if you've got the right material in front of you. But again, I have to say I've been really impressed with the risk reporting that I've seen. It's contemporary, it's often visual, the most important things jump out at you, easy to read, the risk radars and the traffic lights. I think the main issue is sometimes what's not in the report, and really that's more of a people capability issue that I talked about before than a risk reporting. The only sort of trap that I've really seen is an over-reliance on quant-based measures to determine your risk reports. And I do think we need to keep a sort of qual overlay on those, because sometimes they just sort of don't make sense otherwise. Just on board papers generally, I have been surprised at the length of the board papers for the APRA-regulated funds that or boards that I sit on. So a lot of you will be aware that they are often hundreds of pages long, sometimes over 1,000 pages long. So by comparison, the listed company that I sit on, is about 50 pages long. So I think directors really appreciate papers that are, succinct, well-written, get to the point, use the appendices for the background information, and for any optional information, put that into a resource centre. So the next process I thought I'd mention is around decision making. And there's so many things that contribute to good decision making. And I talked about the role of the chair and people and capability. But I wanted to come back to this issue of asking questions, you know, as a way of making decisions. So I recently took over as chair of the Audit and Risk Committees for OnePath Insurance, and sort of, I'm quite a diligent person, so I set about doing a whole lot of background work, and I bumped into a friend who'd run a big life company for a while, and I, you know, we got on chatting to what this preparation I was doing, and he just smiled at me and just said, remember, just ask the right questions. It's all about asking the right questions. And it was such a good reminder, you know, just as I'm sort of in the depths of rereading the life insurance course for the that I hadn't seen for about 20 years. And another good piece of advice that I got recently was actually from a head of risk. And she said to me that she thought that the board should actually ask her more questions. And I was a bit surprised about that. And then I thought about it. I thought, well, when it comes to her risk report, we do ask lots of questions. But when it comes to other items on the agenda, we often don't then bounce back to the head of risk and say, you know, what do you think? And I think that was very good advice. And also it's indicative of the openness of the relationship and the conversation that she can actually tell me that. So I thought that was good in the first place. And the final aspect that I thought I'd talk about is performance. And I'm going to take a little bit of artistic license here and talk about strategy in the context of performance. So I'm kind of shoehorning into this framework a bit. But given my background in strategy, I thought I'd finish with a little bit of a look at how you integrate risk into strategy. So, you know, over the last almost 20 years, I've written a fair few business plans and strategies. And I have to say that the first few, I don't think I even mentioned the word risk in those business plans. And then after a couple of years, I started to include a risk slide. And that was actually a very worthwhile step because it definitely started conversations that had not happened up to that point. But in terms of now, from a director's point of view, what do I look for from, you know, sort of with a risk lens in that strategy or business plan? And, you know, we sort of started talking about this a bit earlier today in some of the sessions. So the first thing I look for is explicit incorporation of risk, not just a token slide like I did in those early days. Consistency with the risk management framework, obviously. But then I look to see whether risk has been... you know, is incorporated throughout the plan. So, and you should be able to see it in quite a few places, in the SWOT, assuming there's one there, in the setting of objectives, the selection of initiatives, and also the prioritization of those initiatives, the choice of measures that are they use, KPIs. Oops. Sorry, I was on the wrong slide there. Anyway, so I've tried to give you a perspective of a new director on the importance of open conversations and try to focus on the softer skills and some practical examples. So looking at people, I've covered relationships, org structure, capability and the role of the chair, process, risk reporting and decision making, and finally performance, having a look at how risk is incorporated in strategy. So I think all of these things help us have more open conversations, and I think that is the key to organisations responding to risk. And I thought I would actually finish with a little joke. I don't know, can you read that at the back? Yeah, I'll let you read it. So, lesson from there, it's let's be open and have the difficult conversations sooner rather than later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nicolette. I'd now just like to invite the rest of the panel up, if you don't mind. So just introducing the other panel members. So Jacob Mamtul is the Head of Enterprise Risk Management at Finity,
and he's an experienced general insurance specialist, and as well as being a qualified solicitor. Now, prior to joining Finity in 2012, Jacob has held a number of senior management roles at IAG in the commercial insurance, personal insurance and Asian divisions, where he's held operational management roles as well as executing a range of strategic risk management and claims initiatives. Jacob. Then we have Rob Curtis. So Rob Curtis leads KPMG's Asia-Pac Insurance and Risk Regulatory Practice and is KPMG's global regulatory lead for insurance. He's currently leading a number of risk, ICAP and CPS 220 engagements in Australia and across Asia, and has recently been engaged in designing the new risk-based capital framework in Hong Kong for the Hong Kong Insurance Authority. And during his time in the UK, Rob was involved in developing the ICAS regime. He led the FSA's Solvency II program. He was the architect of the IAIS Solvency Insurance Core Principles as chair of the Solvency Committee, and also led proposals to create a common framework for the supervision of internationally active insurance groups. That's called ComFrame. And finally, we have Dominique. Dominique Fox is currently the Executive Manager, Risk and Compliance at Westfund Health Insurance. She brings a wealth of experience in governance, risk and compliance management. She's a strong risk and compliance advocate across the private health insurance industry and is focused on using her skills and experience to support business success. So Dominique was the inaugural chair of the HERMA Governance and Risk, GRC, Governments Risk and Compliance Forum. So for those that don't know, HERMA is the industry body that deals with the mutual funds, the mutual health insurers. Prior to Westfund, she was the chief risk officer at the Teachers Health Fund, and prior to that worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers in superannuation and wealth management. So welcome to all of our panellists. And I'd just like to open to the floor for any questions. There should be some mics going around. They're down the back there. So I suppose that the general topic is, you know, governance, the interaction between the board, the senior management and the chief risk officer. Okay, so just to get the... Oh, there we go.
Thanks. Thanks for what you shared, Nicoletta. Ashley Palmer from Ion Hewitt. I had a question. I thought it was interesting what you mentioned on the organisational structure, and I can see that's, I guess, quite comforting and convenient for a board director. I suppose what goes through my mind is it equally a source of risk? Because I wonder whether there's a degree of less empowerment actually in the business, because it's very much seen as figureheads who are kind of controlling, maybe holding more risk, if you get what I mean. Like, is there empowerment across the business because of how organisational structures exist? And I guess my further question is, I think we're beginning to see a trend of less organisational structures in many businesses where it's very collaborative, the old rules of command and control are slowly changing as the future of work changes. So how do you see risk get managed in those kind of new environments?
So is your suggestion that by having a head of risk, it takes away the obligation from the other, the rest of the management team?
I'd probably put it that, I guess one question I get a lot is probably, what is effective risk culture maturity? And there's no really easy answer to that. But I often say, it's when you wouldn't actually need to have a risk function, where the business itself has full responsibility for risk. So I guess what I'm aiming at is that because we've got, I guess, senior business unit heads and risk functions, is there a degree of, well, risk sits over there, I don't need to worry about it?
Yeah, and one example, listen, and I do agree with the direction you're going. One example I heard recently was that even the business units actually which are supposed to be the sort of first line of defence, actually having risk people with a risk title in their title, which isn't really how theoretically that's supposed to operate, and could be seen to be doing exactly what you're saying, which is taking it away from everybody else. So, listen, I'm actually all ears on this subject of, I do, as I said, I think it is more of a capability issue than a org structure issue, but I am actually interested in whether, especially risk professionals who work in the area, whether you think it is whether you think that the structures do work. I might throw to the panel.
I think it can be a risk sometimes having too many frameworks and policies and procedures in place, because it does come down to the individuals and the people and the conversations, which I think we've talked about a lot today around conduct risk and culture and social risk. So I think Nicolette alluded to that in her conversation as well today. It is about the relationships and the conversations, and you can have as many policies and processes and frameworks in place, but without that people element, it's not going to be successful.
I would just add to that. I think the evolution, if you like, of where regulatory developments have gone, because after all, I think if the regulators weren't involved, there wouldn't actually be probably half the amount of risk management oversight and control and whatever else we do, you know, as an industry. So I think they have actually pushed the agenda quite substantially. So if you go to jurisdictions that, you know, started that process some time ago, and you look at, say, UK or the Europeans, you know, there was a very much a process, and I think Australia did the same thing, which was, you know, build the infrastructure effectively for risk management. And then there was a lot of, you know, people employed at the firms themselves. They had bloated functions almost, if you like. And then at the end of the process, everyone started asking the questions, particularly board level, well, what are we actually getting from all of this? And we've got all these people and, you know, these huge reports, and what's it really telling us? So now you're getting a situation very much, and I think Australia has started the process, but I wouldn't say it's anywhere near that from my perspective yet, in terms of then saying, actually, we need more value add out of the risk function, because the guys in the front line, in the business units, they are busy doing their day-to-day job. They're focused on, you know, the operational sides of it. It's not to say you also shouldn't have some second-line people in the first line, to review that. But I think actually if you did away with, say, the three lines of defence altogether, I think then you sort of are at risk in an immature risk environment of actually not necessarily getting the right performance that probably should happen. And so in Hong Kong, for example, where I'm a lot these days, you know, there is no ORSA, there is no CPS 220 or ICAP requirement equivalent. So effectively, you go into these firms, they're not doing any of this stuff. In fact, we're doing an engagement now for a very large group, and they actually say in their annual report that they have a risk management framework. So we've gone in to do the review, and we've said, well, where are your components underlying this? Expecting to see all sorts of, you know, material. And they said, oh, yeah, we've got to build that. I was like, well, hang on, but you're making public statements that this is your risk management framework and this is what you abide by. And so there's clearly a game also being played between, you know, them and the regulator and, you know, the public positions. So I think, you know, you do need very much the second line there. But I would say actually the role is then very much being confused, I think, with what the third line is doing. And so you get a lot of internal audit people being quasi-risk people. And I think there is a lot of duplication coming through. And I think that needs to be better aligned. So you get much more of a, these days, you know, a value add sort of, where are the insights and the analysis coming from what the first line is doing, particularly around credit, market liquidity, insurance risk, ops. You know, they should be actually, how can we further enhance the output and the performance of this, rather than sort of a mere data aggregator and reporting of, you know, material coming from the first line.
So my comment here is, when I was working in IAG, in business, and I was a manager, a portfolio manager, I would have said, yes, risk actually belongs to the risk functionary. It does, it shouldn't bother me. In fact, it was a constraint. It was a bit of a complication sometimes. But having moved to the other side, I'd like to take a different view, and I have. And I guess the view that you've expressed, I think, is still there, that risk belongs or is the responsibility of the risk manager. But it's our job as risk managers, as risk specialists, to actually change that into an education role, into being an advocate, and to impress upon the management as well as the board what their responsibilities are, because we see the CEO as being a frontline, having a frontline responsibility. Now, at times that will change. I'm not 100% in favour of the three lines of defence. I think it doesn't quite work in smaller organisations because you've got people handling multiple roles. However, it is still a good framework. But organisational structures are important, but it's more important that... And this is where I think the CRO or the risk manager is playing that sort of delicate tightrope walk, because they are part of the management team. They are accountable to the risk committee. They're accountable and they're a direct report to the CEO, but they have an unfettered line to the board. But you can't afford to be too close to anyone, because you have to be independent.
So maybe I'll just go with that thread just for a minute. And Dominic, just wondering if... So we've heard kind of Nicolette's perspective on this question of, you know, we have a conflict between a CRO being a trusted advisor and having a hotline to the board. As a chief risk officer, can you share some observations on how you manage that tightrope?
Yes, it's quite challenging. I guess it comes down to the individuals in the organisation as well. I think, you know, some of my peers are probably a bit more nervous with me having an unfettered access to the board than others are. But
it's only your organisation.
Maybe it's my organisation, I don't know. But I think it's about, I think Nicolette sort of alluded to this as well, it's about having open and honest conversations with people. And it is about trust. Like, for me, trust is the most critical component about a relationship, and also having mutual respect. So, and if I did see something that I didn't feel comfortable with and I needed to go to the board, I would always go and talk to my CEO and my peers first, and I would hate to be in a position that I would just have to go to the board rather than having that conversation with my peer group. And I hope that I have those relationships to enable me to do that. But then I also like to, have that relationship with the board as well, having that open and honest, being able to have open and honest conversations with the board, and in particular the chair of the risk committee.
Sorry, can I just make a quick comment on that? I think it's another area that low ego plays a role. You know, you want your risk officer to have low ego because you don't want them to, get off on scoring points with the board and making themselves look good at the expense of their peers. Yeah. And the other one is sort of what you were saying, no surprises. So you shouldn't be saying anything to the board that you haven't already had that discussion with your peers about.
Yeah. A young girl, BT Financial Group. With the recent CBA events, the AML issue, and it's really not about CBA or the AML issue, because it could be any issue with a large, well-staffed, well-run organisation. I'd be interested in your reflections that the panel may have had on that, and what lessons, and maybe what currently keeps you up at night in terms of, you know, in light of that, I suppose.
Well, I think... Thank God it's not me. I think that's what everyone thinks. Thanks God. Thank God it's not us. And for health insurance in particular, I mean, we have we've had a few sort of frontline stories as well with Medibank and NIB, and I guess lack of disclosure, and no one likes health insurers either. So I think that's one of the things that keeps me awake at night is ending up on the front page, and I guess, you know, from that consumer perspective and not providing the right information to the consumers at the right time and being open and transparent.
So if I can make a comment there, the thing that struck me was when you have a new product or a new initiative, right, you need to have the risk review. And it's, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And as Dominic said, you know, thank God it wasn't any of the institutions that I advise. It could have been. I mean, it can so easily occur to any one of us, right? But it's so important. And I go back to an example that I had where we were doing a review of a fraud risk management framework for an institution, a leading institution. And they were actually, you were able to sign up your membership of this fund, and you didn't have to provide ID. If you didn't want the health rebate, you didn't have to provide your Medicare card, so you could put down, you could register Mickey Mouse online. Now, they had an initiative where you could actually sign up online and claim without having to provide receipts for 28 days. So guess what happened? You know, it's and you just think, where was the risk team? And they probably tried. And they said, no, we've got to be competitive. So, you know, having that conversation, having that direct line, and knowing what's exactly what's happening in your organisation is very important.
Yeah, my reflection has been as much, I mean, I think there's a lot of risk management learnings come out of it probably, but I've been deeply saddened actually by what's happened the last couple of months. And I, you know, having worked at CBA, you know, Ian Narev is a truly exceptional leader. The guy is phenomenal. You know, intellect, I've never seen anyone communicate like him. And he's got a very modern and contemporary way of managing. And, you know, his legacy is now going to be, you know, three stuff-ups under his watch as opposed to, you know, what he's actually done. And that makes me reflect on, you know, leadership and what we expect of leaders. And, in my mind, it's a retrograde step that you will go back to a more sort of autocratic command and control, you know, chopping, you know, this whole thing chopping heads. And, you know, my observation, having worked in there, that there, you know, there might be pockets of issues, but there aren't systemic cultural issues. That, you know, when I worked there, I felt like risk was very much, you know, watching over things. And I feel, you know, deeply saddened by what's actually happened and society's expectations of what a leader of 60,000 people is actually humanly possible, what's actually humanly possible.
Yeah, Nicola, I would actually endorse that. I think the experience from the UK, and we've been through this over there, where basically it became a little bit of a witch hunt, you know, in terms of some of the problems that particularly on the banking side had with some of the remediation issues. And we all know that, you know, that's incredibly costly and all that sort of stuff. But actually what it does is it forces, it sort of moves away from this open and discursive, you know, culture that people are trying to engender around risk, and it moves it back into very much a compliance-based nature, because people are then becoming afraid if they miss something, you know, and then it's almost the gotcha moment, you know, within firms. And so you know, the regulator has to be very, very careful here, both APRA and ASIC, that, you know, by having greater accountability and whatever else, and which is all fine, and that should be there as well, that they don't overcook it, if you like. Yeah, because if you do, you'll actually, people will then become quite risk averse internally. They won't want to share necessarily. Then there's a whole, are you really here to get me or not, in terms of, you know, how they perceive risk and that function. And so, you know, it's taken years for people to try and, you know, be quite collaborative and say, look, we're from risk and we're here to be a critical friend to assist you, business unit, in, you know, what you want to do and achieve. So what you don't want to do is get that dynamic changing the other way, where everyone starts to panic and the boards are then sort of, you know, quite concerned and worried from a regulatory perspective about, you know, being fined or being caught out or whatever. So it is a really interesting period that we're going to go through, because if we're not careful, we will end up in the UK situation, and that's where they've landed, because the FCA almost went mad, if you like, in terms of some of the fines. Australia hasn't gone down that route yet, but you just hope that there is a little bit of, you know, sensible sort of pragmatic approaches to some of this stuff, because you're absolutely right. Even the best system won't necessarily get everything covered, and you are learning as you go. But that is a real risk that I think we're just sort of, if we're not careful, we'll, you know, do the same thing as what's happened elsewhere, and you think actually we'll go backwards rather than advancing it.
Good afternoon, John Newman from PFS Consulting. I'd be interested in the panel's comments on the potential for the risk function to actually add opportunity. Now, we've been talking today about risk in the context of APRA-regulated institutions and therefore concerned about downside risk, but there was a little window into that with Nicolette's comment about a chief risk officer suggesting that could add more by being asked more questions, and I'd just be interested in your thoughts about how the risk function in these institutions can really contribute more to strategic thinking and adding opportunity. Risk as opportunity.
I might take that to start. So in the business planning process, I'm the outsourced CRO to two institutions. So in one institution, there was no problem. In the second one, I had to ask for permission. And in that process, I asked, well, here's your risk appetite statement. Why aren't you, and if you've got a medium appetite, why aren't you taking advantage of that? Yeah, as opposed to, obviously, if you have a low to conservative or conservative risk appetite, then obviously, you know, you invest a lot into controls and so forth. But, you know, if it comes to your investment strategy, what's your strategy? If it's medium risk, then take advantage. You know, that means you can invest some of your funds, your shareholder funds, into hybrids or equities. Do it. So I don't have any problem. In fact, that should be, because otherwise our role is simply compliance.
Hmm. Yeah, there's one chair of a risk committee who I work with who always issues that reminder. We hear about opportunity as well. I feel like it's just because of the lack of balance that, you know, the risk person is the one person on the management team thinking about, you know, risk, and the others are all thinking about revenue opportunities. So just to provide that balance. So I feel like it's more a scope issue than anything else.
Well, I was just going to say, I think if you get the right you know, context there, you can also get the risk people, you know, wanting to be on the same page effectively. Everyone wants to grow the business, make profit, you know, that's why we're in business. And so I think it's very much from a risk perspective to get that buy-in as well is, look, we can actually help you even, you know, do better. And there's probably, you know, greater efficiencies that we can also, you know, from a, you know, little bit of a step back, critically analyse, you know, some of those operations aspects, which probably you can't from a day-to-day perspective because you're caught up in it. And so, you know, that's where, you know, what does that mean for reinsurance strategy, for example? Can we take more risk? You know, are we holding too much to net account? You know, credit liquidity, you know, is another good example. Market risk, you know, those sorts of, can we look at the investment strategy? Can we look at different things? That is sort of where I would think the risk function needs to go going forward. You know, so they're saying, look, we're on the same page. We're all got the same sort of reasonably sort of broad, you know, objective, which is obviously for the firm to make money. We have just a specific lens over that. So we don't, you know, sometimes we're at odds with you at all. And, you know, and we'll look at it from a slightly different perspective, but hopefully that adds value nonetheless, you know, into some of your considerations. And I think that's where you get the nice tie-in. If risk is not doing that, then I'd be saying, well, they're probably not doing their job effectively at the moment.
Yeah, excuse me, I'll just comment quickly. I mean, I agree with all the other comments here on the panel. And I think from Westfund's perspective, what we sometimes do at the executive meetings is, it's not just me from risk wearing the black hat. It might be, you know, the CEO putting the black hat on, so which enables then me to, you know, think about the opportunities as well as, you know, and somebody else looking at that sort of the negative or the risks associated with that initiative. Mm.
So I might share an anecdote from my company. So Allianz Australia sponsors the Formula One safety car. And I suppose if you think about, you know, a Formula One car race and all of the safety that's involved in doing that, by placing all of those safety measures around the car, you're able to drive a lot faster. And so from that context, that's the kind of role that, that risk can play in an organisation. Question over here.
Yeah, I find we focus very much on the second and third line of defence and reporting to the board. What I'm finding is we are not engaging sufficiently the first line of defence, and most department the business unit managers, they look at the risk officers and say, well, you know, risk management, risk register, all this your stuff. I find we are not engaging sufficiently the first line of defence. The first line of defence are the risk owners, and we fail to actually make them understand that they are the risk owners. You know, if you ask them to review a risk register, it's the lowest priority they have, and if they eventually you get them to do it, you know, it's very much a tick-the-box approach, unless you really, you know, force them to sit down. I don't know what the solution is. I find everybody's focusing on second, third line of defense and board reporting and reporting to the regulator, and I think one of the problems was before all this regulation, the business unit owners did own the risks. But then when APRA, when the regulators came in and forced the regulation on, it became very much compliance, governance, etc., which was needed because a lot of companies, you know, were not doing it correctly. However, because it became a top-down approach, the bottom-up approach got completely forgotten. And I think we are not focusing enough on the bottom-up approach anymore. Anyway, I would like to...
I'll start. Just a quick response on that one. I think that's absolutely what's happened over the years, and mainly because, you know, when the regulatory expectations came in, everyone went, oh, well, actually, since there is such a first, second, third, and there's quite sort of, you know, siloed approaches here, then we can sort of over to you and we don't worry about them. I think what you're seeing now with the evolution of time and practice is basically the second line is now being embedded within the first line. You know, so you're actually making the first line accountable for its own review of risk as well. So you're not saying, actually, this is not something that you can't care about and that just is someone else's problem. This actually does belong here. And so, you know, who is your risk person here within the first line? And the second line role is then evolving more to be around, you know, that independent challenge of the totality of the operations around the different risk categories. But that actually is getting more buy-in, and that's actually getting ownership and accountability at the first line. And that's when you do get people actually then taking it seriously, because you actually have an embedded second line person within the business operations itself. And so I think this notion of three lines and therefore you can't muddy the waters, I think, is starting to dissipate. And you're actually now starting to see people saying, well, actually, yes, we probably should have our own risk person, you know, not necessarily full time, but, you know, at least someone accountable for keeping us honest within the business, you know, because actually we should own that ourselves. And then you have second line, the true second line, being quite independent and being able to objectively, you know, challenge.
Question over here. We might, in the interest of time, we might leave this as the last question unless anyone has any burning topics. Just at the front.
Thanks. It's Gary Judd from Sovereign. Nicolette, you mentioned your experience of governance structures where you have a board, audit and risk committee, and there's also the other way of doing it where you have a separation of the audit and risk committee. And you mentioned that you preferred the separation. Can you give some examples as to why you think that works better?
Yeah, it's almost behavioural more so than anything, that you, you know, you categorise all your audit stuff and the audit people that you're actually talking to, and then separately your risk items and the risk people that you're talking to. And it, I think it's just easier in people's minds to go, okay, and so instead of sort of mixing them up all on one agenda and, you know, all the different people in the room, that you move that focus from one to the other. And I'm very sure that there's a lot of, you know, superannuation entities that are managing it well within a single structure. You know, I mean, the risk is that you end up focusing too much on your audit and your risk items end up going towards the end of the agenda and they get rushed through. But there's, I think there's a lot of entities that have managed to, you know, get over that and address that. But I still think that that separation is, it's very helpful from a board member's point of view, actually. It's a different mindset as well, you know, when you're looking at the stuff. It's a different mindset, it's different people that you're talking to. So, yeah, I'm quite a big fan.
Okay, look, please join me in thanking all of our panellists. So Nicolette, Dominic, Rob and Jacob. I think you'll all agree that it's been a really interesting discussion on the topic of the interaction between the board and the senior management and the chief risk officer. So thank you. And Nicolette will now wrap up. Just take my paper.
Thank you, Nolene, for chairing that session. So I think we've covered a hell of a lot of ground today. We've had Ian give us the concept of the social risk officer, risk sensing and the Tesla example. Darren's talked about the vibe. Edward's shared these shocking statistics about 30% observing wrongdoing. We've heard from the regulators and that comment from Farmy about the permafrost of middle management, that's stuck in my mind, as well as looking forward to seeing them at our board meetings and our management meetings. I'm sure everyone's looking forward to that. Stephen talked about Japonification. We've had sidecars, the flat screen TV bike boxes, and I particularly liked the Mr. Men risk model. I thought that I was sort of maybe going a bit far with the Diary of a Wimpy Kid analogy, but was very happy to see the Mr. Men there. And yet particularly found the crisis management, the bird strike on the aeroplane. I think that will stay with a lot of us. I didn't realise birds were such a risk to aeroplanes. And thank you to Gloria for that great survey as well. So I've got a few people to thank. Our sponsors, RSA Affinity and Willis Towers Watson. So I would like to invite Benjamin Weldon from RSA, Jacob Mamusil back up from Affinity, and Jennifer Chung from Willis Towers Watson to accept their sponsor certificates that Jess is going to hand over. Oh, and I think we have to pose for a photograph. Can you turn around the cameras over there? Okay.
Step forward. Congratulations on sponsoring.
I think it was an excellent event to sponsor. Okay, a special thank you to our plenary speakers who've done an exceptional job today, as well as the chairs who've chaired each session. And we've also had an organising committee which comprised Brett Riley, the convener, Vern Baker, Nick Cowdery and Jennifer Chung. So thank you very much to them. We've also had our fantastic events management team and other HQ staff who help out, so thank you to them. So you will get feedback form via an email. We really do value your feedback, so please fill that in. And we look forward to seeing you at future events, but please join us now for a drink. And my notes say until 6:30. Sounds like we're going to kick you out at 6:30. No, Jess is saying no. But yes, please join us for a drink. Thank you very much.